Well, this week we want to look at Genesis 47. But before we do, we're actually going to back up to chapter 44. And the reason we're doing that is because, as you know, we canceled services last week. There was another event going on here at the building. And so our family were at home last Shabbat morning, and we read through the Torah portion, Ki Tisa, which is in Genesis. And as we read through, we got into a really good discussion about the events of Ki Tisa. So if you have Genesis 47, you can put a bookmark or put your finger in there and hold your place. And in the meantime, you can turn to Exodus 32, or you can just look up on the screen where I have... I'm in trouble. Oh, we've got trouble up here. There's trouble in River City. Okay, hold. Stop the music. For some reason, things are not showing up on the screen. Did that do it? Something's happening. And all the people listening to the things at home or in the podcast or what in the world's going on there? We're wondering what's going on here, too. Let me just unplug this and plug it back in and see what happens. All right, what does that do? Anything? Well, I tell you what, it's no big deal. We can do without. All right, if it pops up, it pops up. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So, anyways, you can always print out the visuals from the website. You can always go there, and anything I would have had on the screen, you could just print out at home. All right, Exodus 32. I'm going to start in verse 9. Now, I want you to be asking yourself, what happened in the story of Joseph and his brothers? It came up back there. Oh, there it is. All right, we're all good. What happened in the story of Joseph and his brothers? The parallels, the events of the Torah portion from a week ago. So, let's begin. Exodus 32, verse 9. What has happened is Moses is up on Mount Sinai. He's been up there for 40 days, 40 nights, receiving the Torah from God. The God's inscribed the Ten Commandments on the two tablets. And then God tells Moses this: I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them. And I will make of you, Moses, a great nation. Then Moses entreated Adonai his God and said, Oh, Adonai, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent, he's brought his people out of Egypt, and so on. But there it is. And brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth. Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So Adonai changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. And then Moses comes down from the mountain. He sees the golden calf worship that's taking place, throws the tablets from his hand and smashes them, goes down, destroys the golden calf. And it's just an ugly scene all the way around. Then he goes back up to Mount Sinai and says, and this is in verse 31, then Moses returned to Adonai and said, Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book which you have written. All right, you're all familiar with this story because you just read it a week ago. What does this remind you of in the story of Joseph and his brothers? Anybody? You know, when you read this story in Exodus, God looks like he's kind of emotional, maybe a little bipolar. And I know this has been a real problem passage for a lot of folks. But I think Genesis 44 gives us an insight as to what is really going on. If you go back to Genesis 44, you'll note that Joseph, who is concealing his identity from his brothers, they think he's just an Egyptian. But this is Joseph, who they haven't seen for more than 20 years. And Joseph sets the scenario, and he sets the stage to where Benjamin, the innocent of the brothers, the innocent one, is framed for theft. And so finally the brothers are brought to Joseph, and he's looking angry at them. How could you not know I'm a man who divines things? How did you think I wouldn't know your brother stole this cup from me? So he's going to be a slave to me for the rest of his life. And then what happens? Who steps forward? Judah steps forward. Judah, who 20 years earlier sold Joseph into slavery because he was jealous of him, he was angry, he was immature. And so Joseph doesn't know if Judah's heart has changed or not. So he sets the scene to where now everything is just the way it was, and Judah once again is positioned to sell an innocent brother into slavery, to do to Benjamin what he had done 20 years earlier to Joseph. But what does Judah do? He steps forward, and he begins to go over the history of his father. And now his one brother was gone. Joseph was gone. Not knowing this is Joseph he's explaining this to. And then he says, my father's heart will be broken if we come back and Benjamin is not with us. So please take me instead of Benjamin. Let Benjamin go home to his father. I will stay and be your slave. What a change of heart Judah's had. What a change of heart. Do you see that that's exactly what God is doing here? He's testing Moses. Moses, the one who didn't even want to leave Midian. He just wanted to be a shepherd. Just leave me alone. I don't want to go to Egypt. I don't want to rescue your people. Send somebody else. But just as Judah stepped forward and said, take me in place of my brother Benjamin. Moses steps forward and says, God, if you will not redeem these people and forgive them, then wipe me out too. Now Joseph, the whole time he's having this encounter with Judah and his brothers, he's acting angry. He looks like an Egyptian. He's framed Benjamin, and they don't know this. But he set up the scene and he's appearing one way, but in his heart he's yearning that Judah will do the right thing. And how Joseph rejoiced when Judah did. I think God's doing the exact same thing here. All these years later with Moses. Was God going to wipe out his people? No. Was he never going to forgive them? Of course he was. But he had Moses all to himself. Moses, who didn't even want to step foot out of Midian to go back to rescue his brothers and sisters from Egypt. And what a change of heart Moses is displaying. And I know behind the mask, God was smiling the entire time. He was rejoicing. Now, what did Joseph do after Judah stepped forward and shared his heart and said, take me instead of Benjamin? What did Joseph do? He revealed himself. But God doesn't do that. At least not yet. Because there's another test he has to put Moses through. And so we go on a little bit further. But first we see that in the same way that Judah is willing to offer himself in Benjamin's place, Moses is willing to offer himself for the sake of his brothers. But here's the next one. In Exodus 33, verse 3, and then we down to 15 to 17. He says one more thing. Says Moses, go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I'm not going to go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way. And then there's more discussion, but just a short, and we'll go on to verses 15 to 17. Moses said to the Lord, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not by your going with us, so that we, I and your people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are upon the face of the earth? Adonai said to Moses, okay, I'll also do this thing of which you have spoken, for you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. You see, in the same way that Moses expressed his unwillingness to accompany God to Egypt, remember on Mount Sinai, back the first time, the burning bush? God says, Moses, why don't you go to Pharaoh? Oh, man, I can't talk good. And please send somebody else instead of me. And God got angry. But now when God says, all right, I'm not going to go with you, Moses. I'm going to send somebody else instead of me. What does Moses do? In the same way that Moses expressed his unwillingness to accompany God to Egypt, but to send someone else instead, God expresses his unwillingness to accompany Moses and Israel to Canaan, and that he will send someone else instead. But Moses gives exactly the right answer. Moses' heart has changed, just as Judah's heart had changed. And then what does God do? In the next verse, Moses said, I pray you, show me your glory. And then, just as Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers and embraced them, says that, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. And he says, don't reproach yourselves what you did. God sent me here to provide a great salvation. He reveals his identity, he embraces his brothers. Then God reveals himself to Moses. Exodus 34, one of my favorite chapters of the entire Torah. 13 attributes of mercy, where God places Moses in the cleft of the rock, covers him with his hand, makes all of his goodness pass by, takes his hand away, and proclaims and reveals his identity to Moses in a spectacular way that had never been done before or since. So in the same way that Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers, revealed his glory. Joseph, who you sold into slavery, I'm now Lord of Egypt, the mightiest nation in the world, providing salvation for the world. He revealed his identity and his glory to his brothers. And in the same way, God revealed himself to Moses. But Moses had to pass the test first. Judah had to pass the test first. You have to pass the test first. When you grow to the point where you repent of your selfishness, your complacency, in doing God's will, and moving and walking with the Lord, when you finally get up off your tuchus and decide, Lord, I will do what you want me to do, and you repent of it, and he tests your commitment. And when you pass the test, when your heart is changed, then, and only then, can you expect God to begin to reveal himself to you in a very deep and glorious and intimate way. You got to get over yourself first. Only when Judah, his heart had been changed, he's willing to give himself out of love for his brother. And when Moses is willing to give himself out of love for his brothers, the people of Israel, only then do we get that revelation that our hearts yearn for. Do you understand that? It's a powerful lesson. But what I want you to see too is in Exodus, God is not bipolar. He's not emotional. He's not temperamental. But he does test the hearts and the souls of his people. And he tests your heart and soul and mine as well. But it's a test. Recognizes it as a test. Pass the test. Everything's a test. You follow? All right. Now we can get to chapter 47 of Genesis. All right. Genesis 40. Actually, we're going to start in 46 because I'm not quite sure why the chapters divide where they do. But we'll start in 46 and verse 31. Joseph's brothers and Jacob, all their families, all 70 souls are now in Egypt. Verse 31, 46:31. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh, and I will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me. The men are shepherds, for they have been cattlemen. Their flocks and cattle and everything they own they have brought. And it shall be when Pharaoh summons you and says, what is your occupation? Then you are to say to him, your servants have been cattlemen from our youth till now, both we and our forefathers, so that you may be able to settle on the region of Goshen, since all shepherds are abhorrent to Egyptians. So, already there's a conflict. All of Joseph's brothers are cattlemen. They're shepherds. Egyptians don't like shepherds. Why don't Egyptians like shepherds? Because the shepherds from Canaan eat their sheep. Whereas the Egyptians worship theirs. So when you come into a culture where sheep are worshipped, when you come from a culture where sheep are eaten, there's going to be a problem. And we continue in chapter 47, verse 1. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh, and he said, my father and my brothers, their flocks, their cattle, and everything they own have arrived from the land of Canaan, and they are now in the region of Goshen. From the least of his brothers, he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? They answered Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, we as well as our forefathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, since there is no grazing for our servants' flocks. For the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, if you please, allow your servants to dwell in the region of Goshen. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, saying, your father and your brothers have come to you. Now that's a brilliant insight. Don't miss this. Pharaoh had a brilliant insight here. Pharaoh realized his brothers and family could have stayed in Canaan and just sent an emissary every year to get some food for the families and for the cattle. They could have just kept doing what they were doing. Go to Egypt, get some food, take it back home. Pharaoh realized they didn't come to Egypt for me. They didn't come to Egypt for the grazing land. They didn't come to Egypt for the food. They came to Joseph. They have come to you, he said. Now Pharaoh had ordered Joseph to bring them to Egypt. But Pharaoh's heart, over the years he'd spent with Joseph, I think had come to love the God of Joseph and his forefathers. And he realized his brethren came to Joseph. He was the attraction, not Pharaoh and not Egypt. Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. In the best part of the land, settle your father and your brothers. Let them settle in the region of Goshen. If you know that there are capable men among them, appoint them as chamberlains over the livestock that belongs to me. So, the Jewish view was that cattle was for use by man, for labor, to pull your plows and whatnot, and for food. Secondly, they were also used in service to God because you would sacrifice them to God. The Egyptians, on the other hand, brought sacrifices to the animals. The animals were worshipped. They even worshipped sheep. So there's a clash of cultures. So who changed? Did Joseph's family change the way they did things? Or did Pharaoh have to change the way he did things? You see, when the culture of the scriptures clashes with the culture of the world, we do not change. Is that clear? We stand on the rock. We don't get off the rock because that's what the culture around us wants us to do. We stand on the rock. Now, we can reason with people. We can compromise with the culture around us to the point it crosses a scriptural line. And the great example of that is Daniel and his three friends. They're taken to Babylon as captives, right? The Babylonians changed their names from their godly Hebrew names to Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, which are all names of Babylonian gods. Daniel's name, which means God is my judge or judge of God, was changed to Belteshazzar from the name Baal. But did Daniel and his three friends bellyache about their names being changed? Doesn't say they did. And then they're required to learn all the mythologies of Babylon, the histories of Babylon. They're tasked with learning all the lore of Babylon. And they still don't complain. They don't say, we're not going to do that. But the moment they're required to eat the food of Babylon, unkosher meats, now they've crossed the line. They say, we can't do that. But they were wise in the way they approached the king of Babylon. They said, let's have a contest. You have all your guys eat whatever you put in front of them. We're just going to eat vegetables because vegetables are always kosher. And then at the end of the time, you test us. See which one looks better, which one is healthier, and which one is smarter. That was a brilliant thing to do. But you understand how they could compromise in the things that didn't matter, even though those are things that would have made me angry. They did not compromise on the things that did matter. And we need to know the difference. So, let's continue. Verse 7, then Joseph brought Jacob his father and presented him to Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? Jacob answered Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourns have been 130 years. Few and bad have been the days of the years of my life. And they have not reached the lifespans of my forefathers in the days of their sojourns. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh and left Pharaoh's presence. Few and bad. You know, I understand why Jacob said that, but it really isn't true. No one who lives 130 years can say their days have been few. And no one who has fathered 12 sons, who's become absolutely rich, who has made peace with his twin brother who had sworn to kill him, but they had embraced to become friends again. No one who has had a grandfather like Abraham and a father like Isaac could say that his years on earth have been bad ones. But they were very painful ones. Now, we're going to look at that sentence more in a week to come when we compare Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because when God says, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that means you have to look at all three lives together. You need to put them on a line, compare them, look at them. What are the differences? What are the similarities? They form this wonderful menorah pattern with Isaac in the middle. And we're going to do that in a week to come. And we'll revisit this verse and look at it in the context that will help us better understand it. Okay? So right now we're not going to continue any discussion with that. But here's the thing I want you to get out of this. Pharaoh had made Joseph the Lord of Egypt. And as a result of that, Pharaoh got blessed by Jacob, whose name is Israel. And the same is true for us. You know, when Pharaoh made Joseph Lord of Egypt, Pharaoh received Israel's blessing. And when you make Yeshua Lord of your life, you also receive Israel's blessing. When you make Yeshua, who is pictured by Joseph, and I'm not going to go through all of them again, but Joseph, more than any character in the entire Hebrew scriptures, his life more parallels that of Yeshua than any other life in the Bible. When Pharaoh made Joseph Lord of Egypt, then Pharaoh receives the blessing of Israel. When you make Messiah, Yeshua, the Lord of your life, you also receive the blessings of Israel. And you can look at Ephesians chapter 2. In fact, we've got time. I'm doing better than I thought. Pride goes before a fall. We'll probably still go over a bit. But in Ephesians chapter 2, wonderful passage there. Ephesians 2, and just to make it quick, we'll start with verse 11. Ephesians 2, 11. Paul is writing to Gentiles. He says, "Therefore remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, physically born Gentiles, no connection to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You're born of a completely different family line. You don't have the same DNA. Who are called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands. Remember that you were at that time separate from Messiah, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope, without God in the world. But now, in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly far off have been brought near by the blood of Messiah." So now, we're not separate from Messiah. Now we're not excluded from the commonwealth of Israel. We are not strangers to the covenants of promise. The covenants made to Israel apply to us as well. We have hope. And we have God in this world. Now you can read the whole chapter to get the full context. But through Messiah, through making him Lord, the blessings that God gave Israel through the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, those blessings now come to you as well, because you've been grafted into Israel. And you share in the fatness and the root of the tree, as Paul puts it in Romans. You understand? And that's pictured here in this in these few verses where Pharaoh welcomes Jacob in and Jacob blesses Pharaoh. What's interesting, it says twice there he blessed Pharaoh. It's stated twice. We don't know he actually blessed him twice, but it's stated twice. Almost as if to say the Gentile gets a double blessing in many ways. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading more into it. But I don't think so. Verse 11. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers, and he gave them a possession of the land of Egypt and the best part of the land in the region of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Joseph sustained his father and his brothers and all of his father's household with food according to the children. Now there was no bread in all the earth, for the famine was very severe. The land of Egypt and the land of Canaan became weary from hunger. Joseph gathered all the money that was to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan through the provisions that they were purchasing. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was exhausted from the land of Egypt and from the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph saying, "Give us bread. Why should we die in your presence? For the money is gone." So, the first thing Joseph does, all the people were coming to Egypt, and all the people in Egypt, they bring money to buy food, because Egypt has food because of Joseph. But eventually, the money is gone. Now, what's interesting there is that it doesn't actually say the money is gone. In the Hebrew, it says, ki afes kesef. Kesef is money. And what asef kesef means, money is nothing. It's really interesting, but that's the word that's used there. Money's nothing. Can't eat money. It is nothing. That's an interesting insight into the nature of money. I have found that people who treat money as if it's really important are robbed of the ability to truly enjoy it. But people who see money for the phantom it is, the phantom resource, it's something that we are to use wisely, but we are not to be distracted and consumed by it. We realize it's something that God can flow into our lives because of our occupations and our work and our investment of time and being productive. It's something that flows into our lives, but should also flow out. When we treat it like that, like it's wind that blows in and out of our lives, but we're not consumed and captured by it, we have the ability to enjoy it. But people consumed with money never seem to really enjoy money. But the people who are consumed with serving God, consumed with loving their neighbors themselves and serving people, God allows money to flow into their lives. And they enjoy it. It brings joy. But it's not their passion. You understand? Do you know examples of what I'm talking about? So, you can't love God and love money. You just can't do it. It's impossible. So love God. And He'll provide for all your needs. Love Him. Serve Him. Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all of these things will be added to you. You worry about doing what He wants, and He'll take care of providing what you want and need. That's how it works. And He'll bring money flowing into your life to the degree that is most beneficial for you. I've never had a lot of money, but I'm old enough now to realize that if I did have a lot of money, it wouldn't do me much good. It'd probably ruin me. I'd become totally distracted by it. I'd become lazy and complacent, and I'd be pretty worthless. So God has blessed me with less money than I would like to have. And I, in the long run, I'm grateful to Him for giving me just the amount I need. And enough to overflow to other people and to serve Him. And that's plenty. I have everything I know I need and everything I want. But like my mother said, I know what to want. My mother would say, I have everything I want, but I know what to want. So, God has blessed us and taken good care of us. I have no regrets. So the money, that's the first thing. But when the money is gone, we go to verse 16. Joseph said, bring your livestock, and I'll provide for you in return for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in return for the horses, for the flocks of sheep, for the herds of cattle, for the donkeys. Thus he provided them with bread for all their livestock during that year. Now, as you read through, you think, boy, this is Joseph. He's one greedy guy. Well, just bear with me. We're going to see what's going on. So the money's all gone. Now the livestock's all gone. What's next? Verse 18. And when that year ended, they came to him in the next year and said to him, we will not withhold from my lord that with the money and flocks of cattle having been exhausted to my lord, nothing is left before my lord but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Acquire us and our land for bread, and we, with our land, will become servants, serfs to Pharaoh, and provide seed so that we may live and not die, and the land will not become desolate. Now notice Joseph doesn't say, okay, next you've got to give me your bodies and all your land. He didn't do that. They came volunteering that, saying, we have nothing left, but we'll give ourselves to you as our servants, completely and fully, and we'll give our land to you. It's yours. If you'll give us the food to live. And that was the last thing they had to offer. And he didn't ask for anything more beyond that. Verse 20. Thus Joseph acquired all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every Egyptian sold his field because the famine had overwhelmed them. And the land became Pharaoh's. As for the nation, he resettled it by cities from one end of Egypt's borders to the other. Here's what I think is going on. I remember in the Baptist church, we would sing a song called I Surrender All. All to Jesus I surrender, all to Him I freely give. That song came to mind as I reading this. People just keep giving everything to Joseph. But it doesn't go to Joseph, it goes to Pharaoh. What's going on? They gave their money. Money is a picture of your resources, right? That's your resources, your money. Here's the way to think about money. Money is freedom. That's what money is. When you have money, you become freer with your time. You become freer to move about, to do the things you want. Money is freedom. Always think of it in those terms. That's why money is something that's worth saving. It's something worth taking care of and being a good steward of and not wasting. Because I like freedom. But if you look at money as anything beyond that, the money begins to captivate you and you can begin to lose your freedom, become a slave to money. Okay? Time is life, but money is freedom. So they gave their resources. They gave their resources. They gave their money to Joseph. Then they gave their livestock. Your livestock is a picture of your future. Because you have some livestock, it can reproduce to make more livestock, which in turn reproduces to make even more livestock. And pretty soon, you've got as long as you've got that goat or that cow, whatever, you have a future ahead of you. You give up your livestock. It's like giving up your future. You're giving it up. There are no prospects for tomorrow now. Then their bodies and land. This is their selves and their security. Because if you have a piece of land, it's like security. This is mine. This is the place I can call home. But when your land is gone, you become homeless. They gave up their security. And then it says in verse 21 that he resettled them. He reordered their lives completely. You see, what Joseph is doing with the Egyptians is a picture of what Messiah wants to do with all of us. He wants us to entrust him with all of our resources. He wants us to trust him with our futures. He wants us to trust him with our very bodies, our health, our very lives, and anything we look to for security. It's like when he met Moses on Mount Sinai there at the burning bush. He says, Moses, what's that in your hand? Oh, it's my staff. This is my protection, my security out here as a shepherd. He said, throw it down. Throw it down. But this is the symbol of my strength, my security. Throw it down. Throws it on the ground. It becomes a serpent. God reveals its nature. Then he says, okay, now take it by the tail. It takes by the tail, becomes a serpent, or it becomes a staff again. But from that point on, it's not called Moses' staff. It's called the staff of the Lord. You see? And once again, it's restored to Moses' hand. But I know Moses never looked at that staff the same way. Because he saw what it could become. You know what I mean? When we surrender things to the Lord, he often will restore them to us. But now they got his name on it and not ours. And now they have his personality stamped upon them. We recognize we're simply stewards of things that he's lending us for a period of time. And that's an important way, approach to have towards anything in your life. Surrender it to him. Give it to him. Make him Lord and master of your life. And then he will reorder your life. He says, I can meet my life and have it abundantly. The thief just comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I'm not a thief. I came to give you life, give it abundantly, but it will cost you your life. You have to turn it over to me. Just as Yeshua fed the 5,000, how did he do it? A little boy gave up his lunch. Then Yeshua took it and broke it. He took possession of it, and then he broke it. And then he blessed it. But then what happened? The little boy got his lunch back. And so did 4,999 other people. You see? See how it works? It has to pass through him. It has to go into his hands. You give ownership of it to him. And then the blessings, just stand back. That's when the blessings come. But it's got to be given to him. It has to be given to him. Now, I've been yammering on. I've seen a couple hands up. And if you're visiting, you're allowed to ask questions. You wouldn't think so, as quiet as everybody's been this morning. But let's get a microphone to Walt and then one over to Adam as well. I don't care which order. Adam had his hand up first. So, Adam, go right ahead. Are we on? We're not on.
Hey, Adam.
Yes.
Oh, there we go. He's on.
When you're talking about the land, the fact that they said, you know, lest it become desolate resonated with me because the land was their past. You know, it's property typically probably been in their family for a long time. You know, and there's a cycle of, you know, the animals and manure and tending to it and preventing from turning into desert. And it just seemed very interesting that they recognize our land is becoming desolate.
Yes.
We're going to be have a barren wasteland soon here, and we need to change ownership. And there's this combination of this, you know, it is their life, it is their past, but giving that up, and how often when people Yeah. You have to
Good point.
Be willing to completely take on a new identity, but so many people have brokenness that's important to them. Mm-hmm. Have sins
yes.
of the past that's important to them. They're unwilling to give up
yeah.
the past that they left. And it's just kind of showcases the significance of for their salvation
that's right.
to be complete, for them to be rescued truly from that pain they had to go to their land.
Yeah.
May have rightfully been theirs, but it was dying.
Yeah. Good point. So, giving up the lands, like giving up their past, their inheritance. They give up their past, the present, and the future. And, you know, I'm going to say something that's kind of strong here, but it's absolutely true. If you call yourself a believer, but you have not surrendered your life, your possessions, your health, your body, your past, present, future, you haven't surrendered to God, I have news for you. You're not a believer. You're not a believer. You know, I remember when I was studying Greek back years ago, I had this dry-as-dust Greek grammar book. It was like, oh, mercy. It was a definite cure for insomnia, reading this thing. But I was determined I was going to learn Greek because I was trying my best to figure out the Word of God and how to live this life. And this professor, whoever wrote this book 100 years ago, you could tell this guy had no emotions whatsoever. It's like the one author said, if you put his blood under a microscope, all you see are commas and semicolons. But so you're going through, and then he gets to the word pistos, which is the word for faith, pistuo, to believe. And all of a sudden, it's like this guy gets emotional. He takes this one word, he doesn't really comment on other words too much, but this word, he has two paragraphs about pistuo, to believe. And he's driving it home. To believe doesn't mean that you think something is so. It means you put your weight into it. You entrust your safety to it, basically. The great example of Blondin, the guy who is a tightrope walker, walking across Niagara Falls on a rope. And then he goes across, he puts a wheelbarrow across, walks across and back. This is back in the 1800s, and they said, how many believe I could take a man across here? Yeah, all the hands go up. Says, who wants to get in the wheelbarrow? See, until you get in the wheelbarrow, you're not a believer. Yeshua says, get in the wheelbarrow. And finally, Blondin's manager did. He took him across and back. It's quite a story. In fact, at one point, he had to climb up on his back and carry him across. And then he had to get down because Blondin was getting fatigued and he had to rest a while and then get back on his back and go, can you imagine? But he did it. What an example. And if you have not surrendered your life to God completely, totally, and eternally, if you have not done business with him, if you have not closed your eyes, gotten on your knees, say, Father, I give you my health, my family, my resources, my future, my life, my possessions, everything, I'm trusting you with everything, then you don't believe. Because I tell you, if you ever really got to know God, you wouldn't hold anything back from him. Because see, there's one bit of land that was not given to Pharaoh, and therefore was not blessed. And that's what belonged to the pagan priest. They just kept what they had. That part did not prosper under Joseph's hand, because it was not given to him to prosper. And who's Pharaoh in the story? Remember who Pharaoh is in the story? Pharaoh's you and me. So when everything is given to Joseph, Pharaoh is the one who is blessed. When you give everything to Messiah, when you give everything to him, you're the one who receives the blessings. But don't do it for the sake of blessing. Do it because you're willing to be a living sacrifice, because that's only what's to be expected. Yeshua gave his life for you. Now he says, you give your life for me. Salvation's not free. It costs Messiah his life, and it will cost you yours. It's not cheap. And if you're not willing to give your life to him, you don't believe in God. Oh, you may believe he exists, but he's not the God of the scriptures. He's not the Lion of the tribe of Judah. It's some lesser, smaller God than the God of the Bible. And if you're not don't really believe that God enough to give your life to him, then the God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. He's not worth believing in. But this God in the scriptures, he's the real deal. He's worth giving everything to, surrendering everything to. And I challenge you to trust him with your bodies, your land, your money, your future, everything, all your possessions. Oh, and Walt had a comment. You have the microphone. Good. Go right ahead, Walt. I'm sorry. I got completely carried away.
Yeah. I'm kind of make this personal, I guess.
Sure.
I understand what Joseph did in doing that. And God saved the nation of Israel because of what he did.
Yes.
But I see that same system working in our nation today with our government. And I'm a victim of that. I'm Medicare, Medicaid. I have given up my retirement. I've given up my savings. But eventually, my wife and I can pass away. Get our house. I have to learn and live within certain things that they put together that I have to do or I get thrown off the program. I've wrestled with this for years. And I've often gone to this passage and thought about it. And I know what God's doing with Israel. I know what he's doing with me. I touched on that some about trusting God in the midst of it. But this is something ultimately, it's affecting everybody, whether you're on disability or not.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Because when you get done with Genesis, you come to the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 8. It says, then there arose a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. And he undoes or tries to do everything Joseph did. But he doesn't quite pull it off. But he's willing to take the land, take the bodies, take the livestock, take everything. And because he did not recognize the God of Joseph, and of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Pharaoh lost everything. So we live in a country which sometimes is like the Pharaoh in Genesis, and other times it's like the Pharaoh in Exodus. So the people who are being blessed here, they get tested severely there. But God preserves their lives all the way through. And all the wealth that Joseph saves up here, they carried out with them when they came out of Egypt in Exodus chapter 12. When they left, they brought the wealth. They emptied out Egypt, it says. The gold and all the silver and all those things they brought out. That's where they brought the terumah that Adam read about at the Torah service. They brought the gift to build the tabernacle. All the gold, the jewels, everything. It was all stuff that was accumulated by Joseph and that they brought out later when after the plagues and after the Passovers. So it's we're looking at one half of the menorah. There's another side of the menorah. I don't want to leave that out. But the one thing I can say about the whole thing, you trust God no matter what you go through, whatever he takes you through, you'll come out at the end. You'll be blessed. He'll take care of you. He'll see you through. Your years may be like Abraham's, which seems like Abraham. Everything was so easy for him. And some of your life will be like Jacob. Oh, my years have been few and hard, and they've been bad. But all the way around, God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He saw them through. He sees them through. And the story always has a happy ending. Always does. And if right now you're in a place that's not happy, good news, it's not the end yet. You haven't gotten to the ending yet. When you get the ending, it's happy. Every life that's surrendered to God has a happy ending. That's a promise. One more comment. Bonnie, it's good to see you here this morning.
Good to be here. There's just something about Joseph that when all the people, they saw his character, second in command. They were there for 7 years seeing him put the grain away and they were looking at his character. And then I'm thinking to myself, when they start giving their money, their selves, and all their land, they entrusted it to him that they knew someday they were going to get some of it back. That was just like Yeshua with the fish. The people just trusted in him to know that he would feed them.
Yes, that's right. You know, you give him all your stuff and he gives you life and gives it to you abundantly. He really does. Well, we have 4 minutes left, and so let's see. I think we can pull this off. When you get down to verse 25, it says, Joseph said to the people, "Look, I have acquired you this day with your land for Pharaoh. Here is seed for you. Sow the land. At the end gathering of the harvest, you will give a fifth to Pharaoh. The other four parts shall be yours as seed for the field and food for yourselves and for those in your household, and to feed your young ones." And they said, "You have saved our lives. May we find favor in your eyes, my Lord, and we will be serfs to Pharaoh." There was no bitterness. They were full of gratitude. But that phrase, "you have saved our lives," it's one word in Hebrew. There it is. And it's the only place this word is found in this form. You'll see the letters ket and yud there, chai, which means life. And some of the ladies here, you might see, are wearing necklaces with those two letters on them. Chai, life. L'chaim, to life. All right? But this word here, hecheyatanu has means made us alive or made us to live. It doesn't just mean you've saved our lives. That's not a very good translation. But you have made us alive. You've made us to live. It's a word that's very closely related to the word for resurrection. Mechaya means to resurrect. And you've given us life. And you know you can have all the stuff in the world, but what's it worth if you don't have life? And Yeshua said, he didn't say, "I came that you might have stuff and have it abundantly." He says, "I came that you might have life and have it abundantly." So let's just finish with a couple passages that are familiar. But let's look at them now in the light of the Genesis story. Matthew 16, 23, 27. But he, Yeshua, turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. For you're not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's." You know, that's all you have to do to align yourself with Satan. You do have to think wickedness, the black arts and the occult. All you got to do is set yourself, your interests on the things of man instead of the things of God. I know a lot of people who set their interest on the things of man and still call themselves Christians, believers, disciples. They're not. A disciple sets his mind on the things of God. He lives his life here with the resources he's given to serve him. It says, then Yeshua said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself." What that means is to deny your ownership of yourself. Deny your rights to yourself. To realize the deed to your life doesn't belong to you. It is in Yeshua's name, not yours. And take up his cross. That means to realize, I want to be a living sacrifice. To realize I need to die to every self-interest I have. Everything to self-promote, to self-esteem, to put myself on a pedestal. Every bit of selfishness and greed has to die. I have to put to death all those things in me that are contrary to God's ways. And then follow him. Follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Whoever loses his cattle, his money, his body, his land, you get it? For my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his self, his soul, who he is? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and, quote, will repay every man according to his deeds. That's from Psalm 62:12. You know, I hear believers often say, "I'm clothed in the righteousness of Christ." You know that passage is not found anywhere in the Bible. So I challenge you, next time someone talks about being clothed in the righteousness of Christ, remind them, well, that's not in the Bible anywhere. Revelation, John is asking, who are these who are all clothed in white? And the angel answers him and says, well, this is the bride. And God has provided her that she will clothe herself in white garments. And what are the white garments? The righteousness of the holy ones, the righteousness of the saints. Garments she wove together. We have work to do. Don't think for a moment you don't. We have work to do. Because we will then be repaid according to our deeds. Got it? Your salvation is based entirely on grace, but your reward is based entirely on your works. Make sure you write that on the wall of your refrigerator or something. 1 Corinthians 6:19-20. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit? You know, that book by Lois Verberg, she wrote Reading the Bible of Rabbi Jesus. She comes up with this brilliant suggestion. Says, what we need is a southern translation of the Bible. See, up here, if I say you, I could be talking to one person, two people, or 100 people. But in the south, if you're talking to you, you're talking to one person. You're talking to two, it's y'all. And if it's 100, it's all y'all, right? So if you read this verse, this passage with the southern translation, it goes like this. Don't you all know that y'all's body is a temple of the Holy Spirit? Who is in y'all? Whom y'all have from God, and that y'all are not your own? It's plural all the way through. For y'all have been bought with a price. Therefore, y'all glorify God in your... And this, the word body is singular here. See, it's not you that's just a temple of God's Spirit. And you and you and you. It's us together as living stones who become the temple of His Spirit. It's we as a community together really become the dwelling place. Now, it's true that individuals are too. But what he's emphasizing here is that as a community... All of us bringing our gifts and our abilities together and pooling them, that is really where God's dwelling place takes, it really takes up residence. That's where he really resides. Just a few more. John 10:10 we quoted, and that's good enough. We've gone over 4 minutes, I'm happy. So as not to keep you any longer, we're going to close in prayer. And be sure to stay after. And I ask you to give a word of encouragement to Adam Rihanna and baby Ephraim, who is just dedicated this morning. And to give them your well wishes and your commitment to pray for them as they raise this little one. Our Father and King, thank you so much for your many blessings to us, for we are a blessed people. And I pray that we would respond to your constant request in our lives to surrender new territory to you, to surrender to you ourselves, our money, our resources, our bodies, our past, our future, our relationships, our security, our minds, our time. To surrender them to you, you'll never take them. But Father, you ask us to give them. Because you bless what is given. So Father, I pray you'd stir all of our hearts to really trust you. To really trust your word and your promises. For we are like sheep. We are so fearful. And we are so easy to spook and to shock and to scare. And we're so quick to run away. Father, give us the courage of lions to answer your call upon our lives and to respond to your invitation to come to you and to recognize that we are not our own. We have been bought and paid for. So, Lord, it's only our reasonable service to give you what you own already. So, Father, stir our hearts to do that. To really believe in you and not just say that we do. To really trust you. And then as we continue to pass the test you put in our way, I pray that you would reveal your glory to us in ways we never imagined. We have so much to look forward to, and we thank you even now for what you are doing and will do in our lives, in our community, and in this world. We give you praise for all of it now in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.